Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. The U.S. Attorney's Office in Delaware has been investigating Hunter Biden, President Joe Biden's son, since 2018. The question at the beginning of the investigation 5 years ago was about potential violations of tax, foreign lobbying, and money laundering laws. Hunter Biden began working for foreign interests, particularly involving Ukraine, China, and Kazakhstan, during his father's vice presidency in the Obama administration. While he had registered as a domestic lobbyist, Hunter Biden failed to disclose his foreign relationships to the Justice Department, as required by the Foreign Agents Registration Act. However, prosecutors struggled to prove that Hunter Biden intentionally violated the law, but the investigation has since narrowed. The Washington Post first reported last October that federal agents may have gathered what they believe is sufficient evidence to charge Hunter Biden. The potential charges involve three tax crimes and a false statement related to a gun purchase. Delaware U.S. Attorney David Weiss, who's been supervising the case, has yet to indict Hunter Biden, but new reporting suggests that prosecutors are nearing a charging decision. Meanwhile, since January of this year, House Republicans began their own investigations into President Joe Biden and his family. While it resurfaced some of Hunter Biden's business deals, the interim GOP report released this month found no evidence of wrongdoing tied to the president. But it did allege that members of the Biden family, including Hunter Biden, received millions of dollars in payments from foreign entities in China and Romania. So today, we want to further examine the details behind the headlines surrounding the president's son. What are the facts behind the narrative? And how could they impact, if at all, the president himself as he prepares for re-election in 2024? Well, Adam Entis joins us. He's an investigative reporter for The New York Times. He's followed the Hunter Biden story for many years, including a 2019 profile titled "Will Hunter Biden Jeopardize His Father's Campaign?" that appeared in The New Yorker magazine. More recently this year, he co-wrote a piece for The New York Times on the federal investigations into Hunter Biden. And Adam joins us from Washington. Welcome to On Point, Adam.
It's great to be here.
So first of all, I'd like to unfold in as much detail as possible what's going on with the current U.S. attorney's investigation. Can you tell us what they're looking at regarding, first of all, the potential tax violations?
Yeah. So, like you said in your introduction, at the very beginning of this investigation, there was thought that maybe he violated lobbying rules and money laundering. You had all these very, very strong sounding charges that were being discussed. And just to clarify, I'm not aware of him ever registering as a lobbyist. I think he avoided doing so by limiting his role with these companies, so he didn't have to register as a lobbyist. What happens is the Justice Department looks at these instances. For example, he's on the board of a company called Burisma in Ukraine, an energy company there. He takes an equity stake after his father is vice president in a company called BHR in China. He tries to do a deal and begins to do a deal with a Chinese energy company run by this tycoon from China. And so they look at these things. And they're looking to see, was there money laundering? Was he lobbying? They don't find that, right? They find some interactions between, his father and some of his business associates. They have occasional meetings at dinners, but no substantive engagement. And what they come down to in the end, the investigation, is really much narrower issues, very banal issues, such as his failure to file on a timely basis two of his tax returns. Did he take business expenses of approximately $30,000? Did he take tax? Should he? Were those business expenses or personal expenses? Those sort of questions. Mm-hmm. And then at the height of his addictions, he buys a handgun. And he has to fill in a form to get the gun. And on that form, it asks him if he is, you know, using drugs. It's a very, frankly, poorly written form. The wording is very, very much suggesting, like, are you currently using drugs? You know, my understanding is from talking to him and those around him, you know, he had recently come out of rehab and sort of was in and out of addiction. Maybe he thought he wasn't using actively when he fills out the form. Maybe he was lying on the form. It's unclear, but that's a very sort of novel case. Usually they bring charges related to that form to try to basically flip a witness against somebody else. So it would be unusual. It would be an unusual case to bring, and we're going to see what Weiss decides to do, and we don't know how soon he's going to make these decisions.
Right, and I'm understanding that Biden's lawyers are saying that usually for that potential gun violation, that charges are dealt with civil actions instead of criminal charges. But we're going to get to the sort of the background on Hunter Biden and how that plays into where he and the president find themselves right now. But just to stick with sort of this most urgent moment, because he could get charged, right? I mean, we don't yet know if Weiss is going to bring or not bring charges. And again, for, as you said, two years of failing to meet tax return filing deadlines in 2016 and 2017. And lying on the form about purchasing when he wanted to purchase a handgun in 2018. I understand that Hunter Biden recently met with his attorneys, at the Justice Department or in the Justice Department in anticipation of possibly being charged. So is this actually truly an urgent situation for him?
I don't believe Hunter accompanied his lawyers to that meeting. This was sort of a What happens at various points is the attorneys for Hunter Biden want to get a chance to talk to the prosecutors to make a presentation about why they think they should not proceed with these various charges. And I think this most recent meeting that took place at the Justice Department was mainly an opportunity for his lawyers to try to argue for why the gun charge should not be brought based on, precedent and history of it not being brought as a standalone charge. So, but you're right, that meeting maybe is one of the final steps before Weiss and the Justice Department make their decisions. But frankly, for people that have been following this closely, it's very hard to make predictions about timing. It could be that they're waiting for this for another case to be an opinion in another case to be issued, which may clear the way for the gun charge. But honestly, we just don't know how quickly or how long it's going to take.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that big investigation 5 years ago narrowed down at the U.S. Attorney's Office in Delaware to these two potential charges. But nevertheless, regardless of how those go, and we'll talk a little later, Adam, about if Hunter Biden actually gets charged, what impact that could have on his father, President Biden. But I wanted to just step back a little bit and return to where you started with the sort of web of connections and business dealings that Hunter Biden has had. I mean, you pointed out Ukraine and China. I want to spend a minute really understanding the details about that, the Burisma board membership in Ukraine, because, of course, that brings in, President Donald Trump, when he put pressure on then new Ukrainian President Vladimir Zelensky to open an investigation into Hunter Biden and Joe Biden. Remind us how Hunter Biden actually ended up on the Burisma board.
Well, what happens is, for many years, Hunter was working as a, with domestic companies. His father becomes vice president. There's pressure for him to stop the work that he's doing as a lobbyist. So he needs to find new ways to make money to support his family. And they have rather expensive lifestyle in Washington. And so he has a business partner. The business partner is very active around the world. He's got business deals that he's working on in China. He's got business deals that he's working on in the former Soviet Union countries. And he is in Moscow, and he meets the oligarch that controls this company in Ukraine, Burisma. And they have a meeting, and basically what happens is the, Burisma decides it's going to bring Hunter's business partner and put him on the board. What happens is they learn that the business partner's partner is Hunter Biden, the son of the vice president, and they offer Hunter a seat on the board. Hunter decides he's not going to tell his father about this. They're keeping it from his father because they sort of have this don't ask, don't tell tradition in the family. Hunter's business stuff, he keeps, his father doesn't want to be involved in that because of his role, originally in the Senate on key committees. So they just kind of had this firewall tradition in the family. So he doesn't tell his dad, and he joins the board of this company, and they're going to pay him a lot of money every month and for being on the board. And, the reason why, Hunter wants to do it is obviously it's a lot of money. He believes that, at this point in time, Russia has intervened militarily in Ukraine and has seized Crimea. So in his mind, he believes that, the energy security of Ukraine and its independence from Russia is in not only Ukraine's interest, but in the West's and the United States' interest. So he thinks what he's doing for Burisma is aligned with U.S. policy. Some of the State Department officials who worked on Ukraine matters were very uncomfortable with Hunter's decision to take this position on the board because they thought it undermined their message about the importance of combating corruption in Ukraine, something that Joe Biden himself said frequently.
Mm. Adam Entis, just hang on for a second. We have to take a quick break. We'll pick up the story when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today Adam Entis joins us. He's an investigative reporter for the New York Times, and he's reported extensively on Hunter Biden, President Joe Biden's son. And so today we're asking Adam to help us understand the details about Hunter Biden and his activities, the details that are behind the headlines. So, Adam, pick up where you left off about the story about Biden, Hunter Biden's presence on the Burisma board. I first of all just want to understand clearly that there wasn't anything necessarily about Hunter Biden and his own personal expertise in the energy sector that qualified him to be on that board, right?
As you probably know, companies, pick their board members for various reasons. Often it's a figurehead. Right. What was going on in the minds of the oligarch who decided to put Hunter on the board? I don't know because I've actually never spoken to him to find out. But from talking to people around him, he was concerned that his company and he was perceived in Ukraine as being pro-Russian. He was perceived this way and he wanted to kind of reset the narrative. He wanted Burisma to be seen as pro-Ukrainian, not pro-Russian. And maybe he thought by putting Hunter Biden, the son of the vice president, who was extremely popular in Ukraine as sort of the leading of the American effort to help Ukraine, by putting Hunter on the board, he probably thought that that was a way for him to demonstrate that he was not pro-Russian. So I think it's hard to know, why that oligarch made the decisions that he made. But I think that's part of it. He also was under investigation inside of Ukraine. He had rivals in the government at the time in Kyiv. And maybe he thought that having Hunter Biden on the board would maybe intimidate some of those rivals. But again, we don't really know. But for Hunter, from his perspective, you know, he went to Yale Law School. He was working, he was getting into the energy sector. That's what he does also with China later that also mm-hmm. becomes a subject of scrutiny. His business partner, the person who initially got the deal with Burisma, he certainly is sort of a mover and shaker in the world of finance and Wall Street. And so at the time, Burisma was looking at basically raising funds to expand outside of Ukraine. And so, you know, including in the United States, in Mexico and other places. So I think part of the play on the part of Burisma was not having this be a Ukrainian company anymore, but a global company. And so that was what they were thinking. That said, I think it's safe to say that, if not for who Hunter Biden's father was, a vice president, I'm not convinced that Burisma would have been interested in putting him on the board. So, I think he does clearly in this case and in some of the others benefit from who his father is, getting opportunities that he might not have gotten otherwise.
And do we know, you said earlier that Joe Biden and Hunter Biden didn't necessarily talk about Hunter Biden's business, right? Do we know if there was any conversation or contact between the two about his work on the Burisma board at all during the time he was on the board?
Yeah, I mean, as best I can tell, Joe Biden, the vice president, finds out that his son is on the board because he gets these daily press clippings that are delivered to him by members of his staff. And when he got the clippings the day after the board seat was announced for Hunter, there was a headline in the clippings that his son had joined the board. My understanding is what I've reported in the original New Yorker piece is at one point after that, Joe Biden calls his son and basically just says, "I hope you know what you're doing, son." And Hunter says, "I do, Dad." And that's pretty much it in terms of interactions. And I think, to understand the context of that conversation, one needs to understand the dynamics that are going on in the family at that stage. Hunter's older brother and closest friend, Bo, has terminal cancer. Mm-hmm. And the family is really in the grips of dealing with that. They're really worried about money. How are they going to make ends meet when Bo dies, which is inevitable, and he's got two kids? How is Hunter going to be able to step in and basically become, step into the shoes that Bo has in the family? And so that was the context in which these discussions are being had. There isn't a lot of appetite for confrontation over these matters. The family has a real crisis on its hands. And that takes precedence, I think, over the potential political backlash or pressure that comes from the disclosure that Hunter takes the Burisma seat.
Okay. One last thing about Hunter Biden on the Burisma board, because as vice president, Joe Biden did call for the removal of a high-level Ukrainian prosecutor. But was that at the time that Hunter Biden was on the Burisma board? And if memory serves, that prosecutor, Biden was calling for the removal of the prosecutor not because he was investigating Burisma, but because he was not investigating Burisma?
Yeah, so this is it's sort of an interesting episode because I think it has been so mischaracterized. What happens is there's a lot of frustration in the embassy, in the United States embassy in Kyiv, about, you know, whether the Ukrainians are going after oligarchs for corruption. And one of several oligarchs that the Americans and the British government, you know, are accusing of potentially being involved in corruption is the oligarch that runs Burisma. And so the embassy is, some people at the embassy who are focused on these corruption issues are agitating to say something about this oligarch. But, you know, Hunter Biden's now on the board of that company. And so what happens is the ambassador at the time, the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, he gives a speech in which he basically criticizes the prosecutor general of Ukraine for not going after, for not being aggressive enough about going after corruption. And he singles out this particular oligarch. And, you know, what happens is there's kind of shock in at the company Burisma. They feel like they're being singled out and they don't know why. And so what actually happens later is Biden, you know, obviously at the urging of that ambassador, of other advisors, wants him to raise this issue with the leader of Ukraine at the time. And he does. And basically that prosecutor is removed. So It's not that Joe Biden fires the prosecutor to protect his son. He's pushing for this prosecutor to be fired because people at the embassy don't think he's seriously going after the oligarchs, including the one that is, you know, who runs the company that's paying Hunter Biden all this money. So it, in some ways, it's almost the opposite of the way that it has been presented. You know, frankly, all of this puts a spotlight once again on Hunter Biden's position on the board. And it's very uncomfortable for the Bidens at this stage because of this spotlight. So that's the story. So the prosecutor, you know, in the minds, at least of the U.S. officials who worked on corruption issues in Kyiv, was not going after this oligarch. And, you know, Joe Biden is asked by his aides to deliver this message to Poroshenko, the leader of Ukraine, and what happens is that guy is fired, and somebody new is brought in. And shortly, by the way, after the new prosecutor general is brought in, the oligarch that runs Burisma actually leaves Ukraine. That's again, I haven't spoken to him; he hasn't agreed to interviews. But after that prosecutor is gone, that's when he becomes concerned that maybe he will be prosecuted in Ukraine.
Okay. So a little later in the show, I want to, again, get as many details as you can about his China dealings, just as you did regarding his Ukraine dealings. And we're going to talk about that laptop, too. But you've also done some rather unique reporting about the family context with the Bidens, and again, the relationship between the president and his son. And last October, as news of Hunter Biden's potential criminal charges began to surface, President Joe Biden spoke with CNN's Jake Tapper, and we have that tape here. And Biden said he was proud of his son for being straightforward about his battle with drug addiction.
I have great confidence in my son. I love him. And he's on a straight and narrow, and he has been for a couple years now. And I'm just so proud of him.
Okay, so that was President Joe Biden last October. And in a recorded conversation from December 3rd, 2018, this conversation was leaked from Hunter Biden's laptop. Hunter Biden reflected on the lifetime of support he's received from his father.
The person that has lived that life, that has given me this life, is the person I most admire in the world, and I would never change it because it's bigger than me. Everyone else talks about how can you be as good as your dad? I'm better than my dad. You know why I'm better than my dad? Because my dad tells me I'm better than him since I was 2 years old.
It's Hunter Biden in a recorded conversation from 2018. Now, Adam, As people might know, the other Biden son, Beau Biden, he had this promising political career. He had served in the armed forces, dies tragically from brain tumor. And to this day, President Joe Biden talks about Beau all the time. How would you describe, in light of that, what is the true relationship between Joe Biden and Hunter?
Well, I think you have to go back in time to, you know, when they were very young and there was a terrible car accident where their mother and their baby sister died. And, you know, so Joe Biden is a single dad as a young senator, and he's got these two boys at that stage, and the family sort of all comes together to try to help him raise these boys. And so you have this incredibly tight-knit family. And, you know, Joe Biden, you know, say what you will about his politics or whatever, he really, really loves his sons. And his sons adore him. And, you know, what happens is Beau, very early on, he's the firstborn son. He's going to follow, and he's going to be the one who's going to follow in his father's footsteps. And Hunter, you know, he is going to sort of be the, you know, guy behind the scenes who's helping his brother achieve his dreams. The family dream is Joe Biden is going to be president first, and then Beau is eventually going to become president. And the two brothers are going to help their father become president. And after he's president for two terms, Beau Biden, the family fantasy is he's going to become president, and Hunter is going to help his brother achieve that. That's the family story in a nutshell. And, you know, while Beau is in, you know, moves into politics, and obviously we know Joe Biden is in politics, they're not making a lot of money. Hunter goes into business, and that's sort of his thing. And he's there to support the two politicians in the family that don't have very much money. And I don't mean support financially, although, you know, maybe sometimes he's paying for, you know, vacation homes. I'm not really sure. But, he is there to basically help them advance in their political ambitions, mm-hmm. which he shares. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what happens is Hunter has this, there's this terrible kind of curse in the family, addiction, which goes, if, you know, I did this whole history of the Biden family, and this is like really, really bad on both sides of the family. It goes, you know, every generation has this problem. And, you know, Joe Biden never drank, and he told his sons not to drink. He, you know, pleaded with them not to drink until they were 21. And, you know, Beau was sort of the straight arrow. They called him sort of the sheriff growing up. He did everything by the book. And he didn't drink, right, until after he was 21. There's a brief period where he drinks. I don't really consider him to be in any way having a drinking problem, but he drinks like a normal person would. He drinks a lot sometimes. But then he suddenly stops. Mm. He stops that drinking. Hunter, you know, really does drink a lot. But he doesn't realize that he has a drinking problem until, shortly in the early 2000s when he realizes he has a drinking problem. And he decides he's going to go into rehab because he realizes it's causing problems with him, between him and his wife, with the family, because he's not there for the three kids they've got. And so he goes to rehab. Beau is the one who takes him to rehab. Beau is the one who, when he comes back from that first rehab, accompanies Hunter, who's definitely not as social. He's a little bit more introverted than Beau. Beau kind of takes him to the first AA meeting, Alcoholics Anonymous meeting here in Washington, D.C. when he gets back from rehab. And like Beau is the one that finds his sponsor. Mm. You know, Hunter's out smoking cigarettes and, you know, Beau's in there trying to find somebody to help his brother. And that's sort of the relationship that is sort of forged between the two, where, you know, Hunter depends on Beau
yeah.
to help keep him sober.
Yeah.
Right. And then when bow, and occasionally he's having relapses. This is a constant struggle for Hunter, staying sober. But Bo is always there to try to pull him back from the brink. And he's sort of the Hunter whisperer in the family, if you will.
And then he dies.
And, and so he's doing this. He's playing this role. And then he's diagnosed with this cancer, which kills him in 2015. And then I like to see Bo as sort of like the safety net. He's sort of the, you know, anytime Hunter's going to fall, Bo is there to, you know, kind of dust him off and get him going again. But after Bo is gone, obviously, like, Hunter's incredibly depressed about losing his brother, and he has this relapse, and then Bo is not there to pick him up, you know, to help him, you know, try to see the future in a positive way. And Hunter sort of, and Hunter's wife, you know, he separates from his wife, he moves out of the house, and he's separated from his daughters. He's sort of alone for the first time in his life, and he really descends into a deep depression. And now that money from Burisma is coming in every month. That's allowing him to kind of keep those balls in the air, pay the mortgage, the jumbo mortgage bill he has, you know, pay for his three girls to go to this insane, you know, I shouldn't say insane, but very expensive school in Washington, D.C., private school. And so he, you know, that money is critical in kind of allowing him to maintain the lifestyle of his family. But at the
same
time,
Adam, yeah, just hang in here for a second. I'm so sorry to interrupt, but it's a really compelling story. I just have to take a quick break, and we'll hear the rest of it when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and Adam Entis is with us today. He's investigative reporter at the New York Times, and he's been reporting for several years on Hunter Biden and the Biden family. And Adam, before the break, you were talking to us about how after Beau Biden's death in 2015, Hunter Biden sort of descends into a relapse with his addiction, trying to hold himself and his life together. Also, still being on the board of Burisma at the time. I mean, is this the period in which he's making some of the decisions regarding tax filing and that application to purchase a gun that are now hounding him as possible indictments that could come from the U.S. attorney in Delaware?
Yeah, when he joins the board of Burisma, he is sober. He's sober and he knows what he's doing. You know, a lot of people say it was the wrong decision. It was definitely a questionable decision, but he was sober then. But once we're kind of in the summer of 2015, he's an alcoholic again, and he is beginning to dabble with drugs, right? Eventually, you know, maybe the following summer, 2016, he becomes a crack addict, and you know, yes, at that point he is not in a good place, and several of the encounters that Republicans point to between, you know, Joe Biden, who's vice president at this point, and some of Hunter's business associates from Burisma and some of the other places where he's doing business or trying to do business. That's where these encounters take place. For example, Hunter has a birthday party. You know, they're having a birthday dinner. He and his business partners invite some of their business associates, and Joe Biden stops by to spend a few minutes with them. And these are the moments that Republicans are pointing to as examples where this line between to try to make the case that Joe Biden was involved in his son's business activities. And the context here is that Hunter is, becoming increasingly hard to control. He's becoming increasingly erratic in his behavior because of his addictions. He is not really being responsive to his father, who is constantly texting him to see how he's doing, because Joe Biden knows that his son is going through this difficult period. And so the context here is, frankly, that Joe Biden wants to see his son, even if it's just for a few minutes. And so he'll swing by the restaurant where these dinners are having, and in order to basically just to see his son, to see how he's doing, because he's worried about him. But there's this other guy there who happens to be from Burisma. And, from talking to other people who are at these dinners, basically Joe Biden will, he's a politician. He'll go around the room, shake people's hands. Mm-hmm. But it was a superficial interactions, as best I can tell, not substantive. So not really what Republicans are describing, but rather, the actual story is really kind of a sad one of a father who is really worried about losing his second son after he lost Beau, and wanting to keep him as close as possible and just make sure he's okay.
Yeah.
And that exposed him, created these liabilities that were obviously not intended by any of them, but just sort of happened, because of the circumstances that were going on in the family at the time.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know these dealings are so entangled, it's sort of hard to summarize them. But I'm wondering if you could just give us the brief summary of how we should understand Hunter Biden's China business dealings, because there does seem to be an allegation there that Joe Biden himself may have somehow benefited from that. So set the record straight from what you know, Adam.
Yeah. So basically what's happening is Hunter's got the Burisma money coming in, right? But he's kind of falling behind on everything financially. He wants to try to get another big deal. And there was this Chinese oligarch that ran this energy company who was basically trying to get deals with all sorts of prominent people and people who are connected to prominent people. He mainly actually, frankly, focused on the Republican side of the aisle. At that point, Donald Trump was just elected president. He's doing deals with people who are close to Donald Trump. But he also, at the same time, and maybe he's hedging. It's not really clear what the oligarch is up to, because he sort of disappeared later on. But he, is courting Hunter Biden, and Hunter Biden is courting him to try to get a deal. This kind of starts in earnest in 2017. Joe Biden is no longer vice president. He's out of government. He and Hunter is trying to get this deal with this oligarch, this Chinese oligarch. And frankly, the Chinese oligarch is sort of like not really committing to it. And this is sort of what's going on. Eventually, Hunter does get sort of a preliminary deal with this oligarch, and a few million dollars is, I can't remember if it's three or five, is transferred to sort of a holding company here in the U.S. Hunter has several business partners in this deal initially, and then eventually it's just him, and he brings his uncle, Jimmy Biden, in on it. They're trying to get this big deal with this Chinese oligarch, and basically what happens is, separately, unbeknownst to Hunter and apparently unbeknownst to the oligarch, the Justice Department and the FBI were investigating one of his associates, one of the oligarch's associates, for allegedly paying bribes in Africa. And so what happens is the FBI goes and arrests this guy, this associate of the oligarch. And then the next thing you know, the oligarch, who's sort of living in New York most of the time, jumps on a private plane, goes back to China, and then he's arrested on allegations of corruption. And that deal falls through. This is the deal that Hunter was hoping was going to really be the biggest deal of his life, and it doesn't come together. This is at a time when he's constantly smoking crack, you know, and drinking and the rest. So he is definitely not at his sharpest and thinking, he's not thinking clearly at this stage.
Yeah.
And that's in a nutshell what happens with the Chinese oligarch.
Okay. Well, so then we have some tape from May 10th, just a couple of weeks ago, from the House Oversight Committee. The GOP part of the House Oversight Committee held a press conference to discuss its investigations into the Biden family. And while the committee found no wrongdoings by President Biden, its reporter allegedly found that family members received millions of dollars without merit. And so here's Committee Chair James Comer of Kentucky.
These were targeted and specific subpoenas, and each was different based on the information we believed the banks possessed. Every one of those subpoenas returned valuable information that had been unreported and that contributed to this committee's understanding of how the Bidens conducted their businesses. The committee is concerned by the complicated, suspicious network of over 20 companies we have identified the Bidens and their associates used to enrich themselves.
So, Adam, is the money that Comer is talking about there the same money that, you were just mentioning that Hunter Biden was receiving from his China business dealings?
Well, Comer is talking about all these various,
all
you know,
them.
He's talking
okay.
about Burisma. He's talking about the China deal. There was an earlier China deal that Hunter was involved in, an equity fund. You know, he briefly works as a lawyer representing a guy in Romania that you mentioned. You know, so this is all this things that he's involved in, right? And he's also got these business associates who all have their own kind of holding companies that these are consultants basically, and they all have their own companies that they when they make money, the money goes to these companies, and so. You know, so yes, there is a web of various companies, and Hunter has business partners for these various things. And in the case of the ones where he's partnering with others, that money is then split, you know, evenly between the various partners, and Hunter gets a chunk, and the other partner gets a chunk. And you know, what happens is that Hunter gets his third, let's say, of a payment. And you can see this in the emails that have emerged that, you know, his daughters are going to school, like they're going to university, some of them, and they need money. And so every month he is basically using Venmo or something else like that to basically wire money to his daughters. Jimmy Biden, who's a partner in the China deal with Hunter, he has also kids, and he's sending money to kids. So when Comer talks about family members, you know, some of the people he's talking about are basically the grandkids of Joe Biden, who are basically in their 20s, who are going to universities. Mm. So, yes, they get some money so that they can pay their rent and pay their tuition and buy books and stuff like that. You know, at some points, Hunter does transfer money to Hallie Biden, who he was in a relationship with. Hallie is Beau's widow, and Hunter later has a relationship with her. And, you know, she's needs money, and so he sends money to her. There's and there's another relative Hunter sending money to. So there is, you know, he's not wrong that there's money that he gets, that Hunter gets as part, you know, his share of these various business deals that then Hunter then pays out to these other individuals. But as best I can tell from looking at those transactions, they're very banal kind of family transactions where he's, you know, supporting his own kids or Jimmy Biden is supporting his own kids.
Okay. But, you know, here we have the son of a vice president and now president who repeatedly gets involved in business dealings with oligarchs who, you know, their own business practices can be very shady. And some of whom, as you've described, Adam, have been under investigation not only in their own countries, but by the U.S. as well. I mean, Hunter keeps doing this. Do you think that President Joe Biden has essentially given his son a pass on his questionable business dealings because of what you said earlier, that he's concerned about losing another son?
Yeah, no, I think You know, I think that's right. I mean, I think that, you know, the whole family or Joe Biden, I mean, regardless of whether, you know, again, I don't see any, I'm not expecting DOJ, there's no information we have that crimes were committed here, right, with regard to Hunter working with that oligarch or that either in China or Ukraine or in Romania, right? So these are deals with these individuals that many other people are making as well, right? So there's really nothing unusual. There's very little that I can see that's unusual about these deals, except for who his father is and the attention that comes with that, right? And so the wisdom of him doing these things, regardless, let's separate the legality question from it, but just the wisdom of it, was it the smart thing to do? I think, you know, Hunter himself acknowledges some of these were probably a mistake, right?
Yeah.
But why doesn't Joe Biden or other members of his family or advisors to Joe Biden step in to basically say to Hunter, you got to stop doing this kind of stuff?
Yeah, because it doesn't have to be a crime for it to redound back on his dad's political career, right?
Yeah. Yeah, the threshold is obviously, you know, political damage, right? Political liabilities rather than legal liabilities in these cases, in many of these cases. And so, yeah, I mean, to me, one of the things I wanted to understand is why doesn't Joe Biden say, hey, look, it just looks bad. Like, don't do it, right? Why doesn't he do that? And I think that comes back to what you mentioned, which is, basically Joe Biden, you know, maybe he feels a little guilty because, you know, a lot of the scrutiny that comes and is focused on his son is because of his choices to be in politics, right? I mean, if Joe Biden wasn't, running for president or president or vice president or a senator, you know, there wouldn't be the scrutiny of Hunter Biden, right? Mm-hmm. His son. And so maybe there's an element of guilt. My personal assessment, you know, Joe Biden certainly hasn't told me this. This is just my reading of it, is that, you know, he was just very worried about pushing Hunter away at a time in his life where he was incredibly sensitive and, you know, and liable to run. You know, I don't think Hunter would have, you know, necessarily killed himself, but he thought that his lifestyle would eventually kill him. He knew that. And, and so if you're the dad who loves the son and the whole family loves Hunter, and they, you know, they just are afraid what's going to happen. And so, again, I'm projecting here because I do not know what Joe Biden is thinking, but my personal assessment as a father myself is he was just afraid that if he pushed too hard, he would, Hunter would disappear from his life, you know, maybe physically, if not, you know, geographically and emotionally.
Well, Adam Entis, investigative reporter at The New York Times, who's been reporting on Hunter Biden and the Biden family for years now. Adam, thank you so much for giving us all the details, the important details behind the ongoing questions regarding Hunter Biden.
It was a pleasure to be here.
Next time on the show, we're going to talk about medical aid in dying. Vermont recently expanded access to terminally ill out-of-state residents who are seeking medications to aid their death. Three times as many states have medical aid in dying laws now as did 5 years ago, but still 80% of states do not. So we'll talk about what is and isn't changing in how individuals and the law approach medical aid in dying. This listener in Nevada called to share her story. Her husband had stage 4 pancreatic cancer.
He had so much pain that he could barely sleep. He highly valued his cognitive functioning, so he did not want to take much of the narcotics hospice supplied. There was little other relief that could be offered. He finally committed suicide by gunshot to end his pain. Though it was terribly traumatic to find him, I do not blame him. Only I saw the severe suffering he endured. We are more humane to our animals in pain than we are to our fellow humans.
That's next time on the show. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.